time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 23rd of July 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by The Village Butchery, the place to go for fine cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Onirua. On Saturday the 23rd of July, Sharon Brown talked to Di Stoddard from Waiheke Library, health seminar organiser Jill Anderson, and she talked politics and media with Greg Treadwell.
Okay, well, here we go. Island Life, and Sharon here, and we've got Di, who's actually just stepped out from the library, so we'll have her on first, and then we've got Jill talking about some nutritional events, and Greg's going to come in to talk about local, national, and international news. Andy Spence is talking about Fiddler on the Roof. I think he's directing it this time, this particular production of the Choral Society. And the Tetley Joneses might stop in. They're leaving the island, a big radio-supporting family. Great. So I'll get Di on first. Hi, Di. How's it going?
Good morning.
Yeah. Right, so I have to ask you before we start talking about books and libraries and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it was raining really heavily last night, and I know you live sort of down the bottom end. So what was your journey into work like this morning?
Well, I was wondering if, in fact, I would actually be able to get to work because at the Eco Village we have a Ford, and with the amount of rain we had last night and the heaviness and the consistency, it totally... we can block us in. So part of me thought, well, I might not be able to make it, and the other part was I might just get through the rush of water and it won't be too high. So, yeah, it came out this morning and it's quite a fast, high stream of water going right through the ford. So I eased my way in very slowly.
So was it actually covered in water?
Oh, gosh, like... 2 feet, you know, high.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but we're used to that. It happens about two or three times a year. And it's been a lot worse than that. And there are times in my 6.5 years at the library that I haven't been able to come to work. So that's probably, you know, yeah, 3 or 4 times I haven't been able to come in. But the rest of the journey, the rain stopped and it was no wind really, obviously, because there's nothing on the road and there's a bit of water down the sides, but very minimal, impact.
Right. Well, I'm trying to get hold of Ron to see if he can tell us if there are parts of the island that have been affected, but hopefully, it is minimal impact everywhere.
Should be all right.
Yeah. Oh, no, fabulous. Good.
If I can get out, everybody else can.
Well, I'm glad you're not the employer. So tell us, have you got some books lined up for us?
Yes, I have 2 picture books. The odd one comes through and it's just absolutely grabs me. It's like, this is very good. And one I read at story time on Thursday called My Side of the Car by Kate Feifer, F-E-I-F-F-E-R. And Sadie and Dad have been trying to get to the zoo for a while, and usually something happens. Mum trips over and has to end up in hospital, or the grandparents arrive and they have to go to the museum instead. You know, it's like, but we want to go to the zoo.
They just don't get it, do they?
And they're finally on their way, and then Dad sees some raindrops, and Dad says, it's raining. And Sadie says, well, it's not raining on my side of the car.
Right.
And so they're driving all the way to the zoo. Are you sure it's not raining on your side of the car? No, it's not. There are people on my side are watering their lawns. And then you can just see the child who, you know, it's obviously hosing down.
Yeah.
But actually on Sadie's side, it's not, in her little world of wanting to get to the zoo. It's not raining on her. So it's very clever.
And
the parents at the story time got, you know, they were delighted. They could see the humour. And also the children loved it at their level as well. So, you know,
what were the children making of it? Could you tell what
the
older
because it was holidays?
It?
There were some older kids listening as well,
right?
And they got it more than the preschoolers, of course,
right?
But on any level, you know, it's enjoyable from probably the age of maybe 3 up. But there were some boys that were like, 8 or something because their siblings were there or whatever, and they were really laughing, and the parents especially were laughing the most because it's just so delightful. The you know, getting into the psychology of that child's mind, was they've done really well. The illustrations, which are always really important for me, the combination of that, and these illustrations were gorgeous as well. So yeah, delightful book, My Side of the Car. Highly recommend people to order that online or come in, and because it is we don't really have a copy at our site, but just order it and order it over and enjoy it.
Lovely.
So, yeah, and then the other one, which is very clever, is called Press Here. It's been put out as quite a large format board book by Hervé Toulé. That's E apostrophe at the end and T-U-L-L-E-T. And it asks you to straight away press the dot on the cover of the book. And then you follow, and it's just, so there's five dots, and you press the dot, and you open the book, and that dot's changed colour.
Oh, wow.
And then it says,
it's amazing what books do now.
It's fabulous, and then you press, and there's, the next page says, press the dot on the right, so you press the dot on the right, and you turn the page, and that's changed colour. And you go, wow, I think there's three dots, and then it says, press the left-hand dot, and you press that, and it's... And then it's, and you know, and it's changed colour. And then you do that, another instruction, and it's got, and one dot turns into five dots. And then you, another instruction, press really hard.
Oh, right.
And then the dots got bigger, and then bigger and bigger and bigger as you turn the pages. And then it says, shake the book. And they're all shuffled around. It's very, very good.
Oh, okay, so it's got some sort of electronic thing inside it.
No. You're just literally doing, you only just press, you kind of, it's an interactive book where you just press a dot.
Oh, okay.
And then you ask to tip the book. You have to tilt it. And then the next page, all of the dots have, you know, it's just drawings.
Yeah.
But the dots have all fallen to one side of the page.
Oh,
very
okay.
Clever.
Yeah.
And it's it's a book that I think a child would look at time and time and time again.
Right. What age group? It seems very young, but maybe older kids would be quite interested in the intricacies of...
Well, I've taken it home to show my young adult boys and, you know, sons who are early 20s, and my husband and other adults. I just think all of us at the library have thoroughly enjoyed it, just giggling as we're turning, you know, going, following, feeling stupid following the instructions. And but it's just so magical and delightful.
Oh,
and the movement
lovely.
Of these dots, which I just drawn and painted. But, yeah, once again, a very, very clever book.
So that sort of optical illusion.
So you feel a bit silly kind of pressing the dots and shaking the book and tilting it, hoping nobody's watching you. But it is truly magical.
Yeah.
And once again...
It's interesting, isn't it, where books have got to?
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing of, like, what is a book now? It's completely changing our conceptualization of what it means to have a book, like a book that you pick up and shake to enjoy. It's quite bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a board book. And so most of the picture books that come through, I'm not really taken to too much. But there's the old one that really strikes me as being very, you know, stunning. And, you know, these two books would be the sort that I would want to buy and keep, you know, because that doesn't happen very often that you want to buy, that I would want to buy a book. But these are quite special.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. So, Press
anything,
Here, it's called.
Anything for adults? Like adults who don't want to be children, but just adults who want to do adult stuff?
You mean a novel for adults?
Yeah, a novel or non-fiction. Anything nice that you've read recently?
No, I've been concentrating on that. I mean, at the moment, I'm doing a lot of website reading just for my own sake, you know, how to outsmart Google and how to make money off the web and all that kind of technology stuff and all the social media that they say is so important now to have an interactive or successful website. So I'm just doing a lot of non-fiction reading myself. The book club, if everybody wants to know, the book club at Waiheke Library is reading Book.
Oh, okay.
By
what's
Fiona,
that?
New Zealand author Fiona Farrell. It's been out for ages, but it's one of the ones we haven't read and apparently really good. So I'm only just starting it, but it's one of those books that most people really have really enjoyed. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
lovely.
Right. So just some other quick notices from the library. Today, because it's the holidays and we've got lots of books to sell, we're going to do an extra special sale price of five books for a dollar.
Oh my goodness.
So we've got a lot to get through and get rid of.
So I have to say, I do love that pile of sale books, because I find sometimes it takes me long. I like to have books lying around for when they take my fancy.
Yes.
And I can never seem to read the library books quickly enough. And so I just, you know, I just find in that stash, it's a bit like being in a bookshop, you know, you just find something that you didn't expect to find.
There's such an eclectic variety of all areas of nonfiction and all areas of fiction. So do come in with your bag and pick out five for a dollar. They're normally much more than that, you know, $2 for nonfiction and a dollar for fiction and so on.
Mm.
But we're just going to go for it today.
Right.
And
okay.
have a book sale.
I wasn't here. I'd
yeah, five for a dollar.
Yeah.
So there's quite a few. So when you finish your show, I'm sure there'll be some left. Now, the holiday program, we're in full swing,
very
successful, and I think partly because it is free, and it's nice for families to be able to join in with something that's free.
Mm.
So this Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we've got a huge game of bingo going on.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's really good for children's numeracy and also for their speed of finding the number on the card and covering it with a button. So we've borrowed Kieran Craft's big set. We've got a caller because bingo calling is quite a specialist kind of technique. So
I'd love to see that because I've never actually seen a proper bingo caller, but it sounds terribly exciting.
And so I thought I could call numbers, but it's just not the same.
No.
So
I think it's a 16.
And I know that. Oh, I used to do it way back in the 70s, raising money for my hockey team. I wasn't calling, but yeah, I remember the calling. It's quite intriguing. So lots of kids will be able to join in with that on Wednesday. And now what kids are enjoying, we've had lots of people take the entry form for the short story competition.
Oh, okay.
So come in and get your entry form. You can write as many words as you like, whatever inspires you, and there's two age groups and fabulous prizes at Take Note. And the other and I think that's about it, really. And, of course, I always want to encourage families to join the library, because it's just such – we were talking the other day with the patrons, like such a fabulous thing to give your children.
Mm.
Just, you know, the plate, just to come in. And you can tell the kids that have been there for years from when they were little, because they know how to choose their books. They know the shelves. They know what they like. And it's just a lovely family time. Come in for an hour. Little ones, you know, do the puzzles. You know, it's just a gift of a lifetime to – you know, to have that in your family routine. So
I know I got my daughter a library card. Of course, it's annoying because I have to chase up the fines.
Yes.
Blah blah blah.
Blah blah blah.
But I have to. But I, you know, I like. You know, I thought it was a special thing to give her.
Yes. Yeah. And if they can take and they loved, you know, taking responsibility for it. It's a whole kind of. It's the beginning of, you know, getting your child to be responsible for something, and it's. And if you limit their books, and then they can manage it, and they have a special library bag or a special place where their library books go, and it's just so much joy. And then when it comes to study, they've got, you know, all the project material, and of course, being part of Auckland Libraries, which as we know is phenomenally huge now, the catalogue is mind-boggling. You know, fantastic. It's just...
No, lovely things. And I have to say, the thing that the DVDs are cheaper now is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah,
and they've got such a great, you know, foreign collection and sort of art house collection.
Yeah.
It's fabulous to go
and
through.
And the children don't have fines anymore, actually. So,
oh, don't they?
No, but that's no excuse to bring them back later on purpose.
No,
but, you
no,
know.
No, no, no. Oh, okay. No, I just...
Yeah, yeah. It's just, but it is nice that there are no fines. Of course, if they borrow an adult book on their card, well, that's different. But it's quite nice that there are no fines
on
children's
good.
Books. So,
Yeah. Oh,
good.
No,
so there you go.
Great.
The sun is shining.
Yes.
I think we might be busy today.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, thanks very much for coming in. That's fabulous.
Thank you, Sharon.
Yeah. Enjoy the rest of the holidays. Well, millions of people in the library,
I'm sure. You know, our numbers are up, of course.
Yeah. No, great.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot for coming in and talking about books.
Kia ora. Bye.
Wakey Radio.
Right. Well, now I've got Jill Anderson, who's organised a seminar on health and wellness at Tuhurahi next weekend. So, Jill, you're a nutritionist, recently qualified.
That's right. Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you.
So what's the seminar you've organised? It sounds quite exciting.
It's based around all of the practitioners on the island. I've invited as many as I possibly can. And the idea is to showcase the alternative practitioners on the island, as well as the local food producers. Although, sadly, a lot of them haven't... I haven't got that many of them. and also our local gardens, community gardens. So that's been really good. They've come on board and they're going to be doing seed planting with the children. So that'll be fantastic.
Oh, lovely. And so what gave you the idea to do this? Why did you think it was something that would be useful to do or interesting?
I think that often we're quite splintered, you know, that we don't know who's out there and who to refer people to, because not everybody needs the same thing in their life. So to get us all together and all of us talking together would be fantastic. So just, and also to make the public aware of who's out there and what's out there, you know, and what's available in our community.
And what particular benefits do you think you can get from alternative health therapies? Because I think one of the issues facing people who might be quite interested is first of all, the expense, and secondly, not knowing whether that's really what they need.
Well, this is precisely why something like this would be really beneficial, because you're showcasing what's out there. It gives the public a chance to be able to speak to practitioners and find out exactly what they do, whether it suits them or not. And the thing about doing that is it's of no charge to the public. There's a small koha to get in, but that's all. So then people have much more of an idea. There's also in the front room, we're running some speakers and some classes in there, so people can come in and participate in those as well and listen in for a small charge also. So that also gives people much more of an idea of what's happening as well.
Oh, lovely. So you can try out some of the different therapies or get some advice. Yes,
absolutely.
Okay, that sounds
yes.
lovely. Good. And the local producers are sort of also talking about what kinds of, giving people advice on their gardens and what they could be growing?
Yes, the local community gardens, this Ostend and Blackpool. And they'll be the, and our local herb group, which is in its infancy, is also going to be represented there, which will be lovely because that will actually push them out into the public eye a bit more. There's a lot of people that don't know they exist. So it's just really about letting people know what's available here on the island.
Lovely. Oh, no, that sounds great. So tell us, you've just finished a course in nutrition.
That's right. I've just done a diploma of nutrition at Well Park College in Grey Lynn.
Right. Okay, so what made you choose to do that?
I've been interested in food probably for 25, 30 years.
I'm interested in food, but it doesn't make me go into a nutrition course.
Well, how food benefits the body, I guess. I've had many circumstances in my immediate family and friends where I've seen food make a huge difference in people's lives. And that was the driving force. Plus, I think I was painting houses for a business, and I think I'm a little bit beyond that now. So it's nice to do something new and use my brain as well. And something that I'm passionate about too.
So have you got any particular tips of something that's really easy but really beneficial, as a particular sort of power fruit or vegetable, or a particular, I don't know, way of cooking something that's so much better, or some sort of tip that you could share with us?
Gosh, there's so many of them. Probably number one tip is make sure you drink plenty of water. Sugar is probably one of our worst enemies. Don't eliminate, but keep sugar to an absolute minimum. And
well, this isn't fun.
Sorry,
I wanted some fun things like
eat as wide a variety of food, I think, is the answer. As fresh, and this is one of my beliefs, is eat local, as close to home as you possibly can. So, you know, advertising that in this way with this seminar is really much more beneficial for people to eat in season and local produce.
Right. Okay. Great. Well, thanks very much for coming in. Any particular highlights of the coming weekend? Someone that might be a bit unusual, or some therapy that hasn't been seen before? Or
I think there might be a few therapies that people might be quite surprised about, that we have practitioners on the island that are doing it. But we have a special guest speaker coming on Saturday afternoon at 2:30, Jason Bennett, who used to live on the island, so quite a lot of the older people know Jason. He's really dynamic and he's really funny, so he's well worth coming to see. So I'd recommend coming around about 2:30 and have a listen to Jason.
Lovely. What's he talking about?
How to change your life.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. Mm.
Okay. And so tell us the opening times of this.
9:30 till 4 o'clock, both Saturday and Sunday.
Great. And you can just drop in, talk to different people, maybe try a few things out and listen to Jason speak if you come on the Saturday.
Absolutely.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much for coming in. Good luck with that. Sounds like an amazing event.
Thank you.
Lovely.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Right, well, we've got Greg in, who's come to talk about local, national and international news and what's been happening in the last month. There's been some quite interesting stuff, I think, both locally and internationally and nationally.
Good morning.
Oh, and let me just switch on your mic.
Thanks.
That's nice, isn't it?
Yes. Good morning, Sharon. Good morning, everybody. Yep, it's nice to see really nice, clean microphone covers in the studio. Just letting the people know that things are changing up here.
Yes, indeed. And
this one doesn't actually
holders that actually, you know.
Yeah, this one doesn't actually feel like it's got the spittle of 1,000 interviews.
No, I know.
No.
Okay, great. Okay, well, what have we got in the news then? What's caught your fancy?
Well, to be honest, there's only one story for me at the moment. There's only one story for me at the moment, and that's the news of the world. What began with the news of the world and is so much wider than the news of the world now. This morning, the latest news is that James Murdoch, the son of Rupert Murdoch, is going to face... I like the Herald's headline this morning because it was James Murdoch to face police probe. And if you just took police out, everybody would be really happy, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
I'd give a couple of other probes I'd like James to experience. But the whole... he's basically been... The pressure is now on him to prove that he hasn't misled Parliament, which he and his father Rupert went in front of a panel of MPs in the UK this week, which is in effect the same as addressing Parliament. And he was asked directly if he knew of this email that's known become known as the Tenneville email, and it outlined a lot of the... it contained some transcripts of stolen phone messages and stuff. And James Murdoch said plainly to the parliamentarians that no, he had not been made aware that this email was in existence, because it contradicted what he had said, which was that he thought it was limited, the phone hacking was limited to one rogue employee. And that's a, you know...
has since been totally disproved.
That's been totally disproved. And James Murdoch is saying, well, it might have been disproved, but I didn't know at the time. Now two of his former senior, including the editor of the News of the World when it was shut down a week ago, have said, we told him about this email.
Mm.
And they've gone on record to Parliament saying that Mr. Murdoch must be, quote, mistaken. His memory must be mistaken, because we told him that this email existed that proved it was widespread throughout the organisation.
So who was the email from? Or what,
no, I don't know who it was from.
Or what were the contents of it?
The contents of it were the transcripts of intercepted phone messages.
Oh, I see. So it's obviously,
it proved it was to an employee called Neville Thurlobler, I can't remember his name, but to a senior employee called Neville somebody, and it contained transcripts of multiple phone messages that had been intercepted by dirty scumbag reporters. It's just looks very poor for James Murdoch. I don't know what his explanation will be. He's got to go back now and talk to the police about why he might.
So, what is the Murdoch empire at the moment?
Well,
what does it?
Let me tell you, News of the World is 1% of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the everybody was quite surprised by the initial move of James Murdoch, obviously with his father's approval, to shut the newspaper down, because it was seen as a cash cow for the empire. But of course, the empire is much, much bigger than that. It's Murdoch gets most of his money from television, not newspapers.
Mm.
And one, albeit well-known title in the UK, is not going to bring him down. So,
So what are his major television networks?
Oh, to be honest, I'm not an expert in that area, but he's the big thing he's trying to... he owns Sky, doesn't he?
Mm.
Yeah. So the big thing he's trying to been doing recently and was get a major controlling stake in B Sky B, which is a pay-per-view channel, pay-for-view channel in the UK, and reportedly worth a lot of money. Murdoch was in the process of trying to buy this and was looking very likely, much to the horror of commentators who think he already owns too much of the world's media.
Mm. So, you know, obviously there's, you know, the email and did we know about it, did we not know about it, etc., etc. But, you know, what are the bigger implications as a journalist? What are the bigger implications of A, the phone tapping, B, the discovery of it, or, you know, just this whole thing generally?
Yeah, well, the implications, as a commentator in the Herald put it today, go much further beyond journalism. I'm less concerned as a journalist about this scandal, I'm less concerned about its impact on journalism than I am on its impact on media ownership. Now, my view is that media ownership needs to change. The way we organize the media in Western liberal democracies has become a hegemony of capitalism, a sort of a holding place for you know, news is no longer news is becoming a product that really is irrelevant in content. Now, a lot of working journalists will be horrified to hear me say that, and I know how hard working journalists, good working journalists, work.
I think fundamentally when we say that, what we're really saying is that the media consolidation means that there are something like 7 global companies that own over 90% of all media outlets in radio, television, and print journalism. That's what it means, really.
Ultimately, that is what it is. They're not interested in what is written as much as how well it sells. In some ways, you can't blame that. I mean, we can't blame them for that. I mean, I was asked by another interviewer recently, what is going on? Why is this happening? And I was surprised that he was naive to think that the motive for shutting the News of the World down might not have been its impact on the B-Sky B deal or the profit margin of News Corporation in general. Because really, the decisions being made about our media that affect the platforms it's on, the ownership of them, and to some degree the culture within the newsrooms, they're being driven by companies that don't have an interest in news. It's just, it's called News Corporation, but quite frankly, you know, it really should be called shareholder interest. And I don't have a problem with that, of course. In every company, publicly floated company in the world, has their first responsibility is their shareholders. But is it appropriate that a company with their first obligation to their shareholders owns that much media? And I think that the impact of this whole thing is way beyond journalism. It's the influence has gone to David Cameron's under pressure because he employed one of these people who's now been arrested for these illegal activities. Senior police in the UK are tumbling every week. There seems to be another one going down. The initial whistleblower is dead. This is huge. But again, I come back to this point that journalism isn't necessarily heading for hell in a handbasket here. It was journalism that exposed this. And the evil here is not in journalism. The evil here is in the move out of good journalism that is driven by the need for profit.
I think it's also the fact that it becomes almost, I don't know about socially acceptable, but it suddenly becomes so widespread that you get a feeling of like, well, it must be quite normal for various people to be tapping your phones. And, if that's a journalist or if that's the police or, you know, well, that's just a fact of life, as opposed to really standing up for our civil liberties and saying, well, it's just completely unacceptable that anyone is tapping our phones. And how is it possible that journalists were even able at any level to get those kinds of privileges? I mean, what does that say about our national security that some lame-o journalist from some newspaper can get access to stuff that's incredibly personal?
The insult behind that is outrageous. I agree. We have to be clear that this isn't some technological device they've got to pry into your life. This is guessing your PIN number. This is how they did it. Many people, we're now realizing, don't have PIN numbers on their voicemail. And therefore it's pretty easy to get in. And even those who do have PIN numbers tend to, according to reports that are emerging around this issue, you know, use your mum's birthday or things.
Yes, well,
things
that's because
that
it's really difficult to remember like 5,000 different PIN numbers.
I know, and every online account has a password,
and
it's absolutely, we've got to come down to kind of voice print stuff, don't we, or thumbprint identification or something. Like, I know it sounds scary, but
it does sound scary, Greg. We don't want thumbprint identification.
I think it's just more reliable than 20 dodgy PIN numbers.
Right.
I mean, okay. That's all, and I think. Yeah, so this isn't sort of technological futurism, really. This is just, you know, people not looking after their own online security or their own voicemail security, and it's perhaps arguable it's a shame we have to do that, but in the 21st century,
Now, this other thing about the news that sells, that's what I don't understand either. It seems to me that news that might sell might be what's going on in the world, but we don't get that. So how is it that we get this kind of constant fodder of, you know, who killed who and who bashed who and these kind of quite specific stories that don't focus on root causes of problems or, you know, global events, but become more and more sort of smaller kind of news items about particular cases of police brutality or whatever? Because I consequently don't buy the newspaper because I'm not interested in these kinds of things. So why do we always say that news sells when it's these kinds of things?
News isn't an academic exercise. News is a mix of what sells and what's important, and it always has been. Even a very good newspaper will have some stories that lead off with the human interest drama angle. You'll have, you know, perhaps the best way into this story is that this was a mum with five kids and she died on the road. And, you know, perhaps the drama of the sensationalist story is not restricted just to bad journalism. And so drama is an important element of any narrative, any social narrative, any narrative genre. Drama is an important part. If every story in a newspaper was statistically based and... you know, highbrow, then you're just not going to have the readership. So it is always a balance of making sure you're providing, and if you like, you know, you've got to sell your newspaper. There's no point in doing it if nobody reads it. You've got to have readership. So you have to provide a mix of information. News isn't, you know, you and I can sit here and argue about what's the democratically significant news that must be in our newspapers, and it must be. But the truth is a lot of people just need some relaxation and some sport and stuff. There's just nothing.
Oh, no, that's fair enough. And I certainly wouldn't want to be, I mean, I can't stand like The Economist or, you know, I find it really difficult to read things that I like really statistically heavy or whatever.
Yeah.
But yes, but it just is, it is wearisome when, you know, half of the front page is covered by some sort of...
Well, that's right. And
event that seems fairly trivial. But yeah.
So just to finish off what I was saying, it may be that, I mean, a good newspaper is a mix of stories and a mix of styles and a mix of levels of impact. To be honest, you do need some lifestyle news. You do need some features, and you do need the kind of broader interest stuff. I'm not arguing, though, for a front page that is always the latest disaster car crash. And it's well known that the Herald front page these days is an attempt to bring in, believe it or not, younger readers. They seem to think that younger readers need these stories. Younger readers, of course, are abandoning newspapers in the droves, which you can't really blame them for when everything is so accessible online. And you can actually manipulate the stream of news that comes into your world, and you don't have to plow through the, you know, some of the stodgy stuff to get to what you really want. But news is certainly becoming not mostly because the resources going into news are shrinking. News is becoming more of a once over lightly.
Okay, great. So I guess then another question might be that notion of media consolidation. How can one fight media consolidation? Is that something that needs to happen at a governmental level, that media ownership is restricted, or what is the solution to that?
Well, what's the solution? That's, I guess, what everybody's arguing about. There's a wonderful, from my point of view, a wonderful American academic in this area called Robert McChesney. and he's coming out to a conference at AUT later this year. It's going to be very interesting to hear what he says. His argument, and those with whom he's written a book recently, argue that ultimately not all but a significant amount must of news media, particularly news media, must be state-funded.
Right. Okay.
And of course, this is just to the deregulated markets of New Zealand and other places. This is ideologically heinous. The idea of government-controlled media, and of course, the whole argument of the Soviet bloc is brought up every time this is mentioned. You can't have state-running media. Well, of course we do. We have, to some degree, Television New Zealand. We have Radio New Zealand. We have state media. Okay. Australia has SBS, which is a sort of angle on state media that we don't have. State media exists everywhere. It should be, and the current ideology is that it must be in balance with privately owned media. Mm. One, because state media, of course, has no commercial imperatives, but it's owned by the state, and it's incredibly important that the media is scrutinizing the state. And if it isn't scrutinizing the state because it's owned by the state, if it isn't adequately scrutinizing the state, of course that's a major issue. But you have, in the system we have, a balance on the free enterprise side of the media market that would say, well, we might be chasing profit motives more, we might be littering our news with advertising, but we're not owned by the state and we'll give them a good kicking when we need to. So that's the sort of argument for the balance we have. But unfortunately, the balance has got so out of kilter that these Murdoch-type enterprises are running the world's media. Robert McChesney argues that initially the media in America was publicly funded. And this is a bit of American history I'm not entirely sure of, but having just sort of about ploughing halfway through his book at the moment, he says that when newspapers began in the States, they were in fact funded by the principles laid down by the founding fathers to ensure that a democracy grew and that it wasn't entirely privately owned, the media. So, so he's arguing that in the long term we have to return to a much more publicly funded news media environment. Mm. And
did you hear that they've disbanded the charter? That happened 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
the New Zealand.
That's what I mean. Television New Zealand. You mean the TVNZ charter? Mm. Television New Zealand is and isn't a state-owned broadcaster, in my view. Even if the government's the key stakeholder, shareholder. Mm. It doesn't operate. Much more important is the way it operates than actually who owns the shares. So you can argue it's owned by the government, but it doesn't behave in any way like a publicly obliged broadcaster. My personal view.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, and they have had that insistence on a return on investment, and then taken the money that it's made and ploughed it into other services. Nonetheless, I think the charter did provide a certain protection to children's programming or Maori programming, and some of the documentary stuff was sucked up by reality TV, but at least there was some sort of vague commitment to having local content or certain time slots, admittedly not very good ones, restricted for minority groups, etc., etc. And it seems like such a shame that that has gone as well.
Yeah, and there was some guarantees, I suppose, but wasn't there the argument made by TVNZ that Crime Watch was part of their Maori programming? I mean, that's just an insult to the treaty and just not okay. In my view, and
I think it's a real shame that we take these little examples of something and then say the whole thing isn't working, rather than reworking the charter so that Crime Watch can't be part of that.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right. I wasn't. Yeah. I'm not for getting rid of the charter. If they've got rid of the charter.
They do think it's if they get in for a second term, they're going to sell it. Blah blah blah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see it. I can see that happening. I guess I'm not feeling that strongly about the charter because in my mind it's already lost.
Yes.
So,
although I thought Roger Horrocks had a good point. He's a media academic, and one of the things that he said is that you need something which is a state-owned broadcaster. And if you sell it, then you have nothing which is a state-owned broadcaster. So even if it's not delivering on local content or the way it's run is poor or whatever, once you lose it, it's gone, and it's very difficult to get back.
And I guess I'm saying, in my heart, I've lost TVNZ already. I would like to see the state, and I agree with Roger very much on state broadcasting. I think it's the key player in the media market is the state broadcaster. It sets the standard in many ways, and I think that the state broadcaster of the future should be a triumvirate between Radio New Zealand, Māori Television, which is publicly funded and secure under an act of parliament, and a government website, a government publicly funded news agglomerating website.
I think that's interesting.
I think that that tripartite.
How would that work?
Well, I don't know in detail, but I think.
So something along the lines of the BBC or something, is that, you know?
Well, nobody's got the funds in New Zealand that the BBC's got, or even a trust model like The Guardian. Trust models are interesting for news media. I wasn't aware until I looked into this a little while ago that papers like the Irish Times are owned by a trust.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, one of the interesting things about the Irish Times is that in one of the points in its trust document is that it must oppose war in all forms. All times.
Oh, interesting.
So for an editorial policy that will never support a government-initiated war, or even in defence terms, it will not support war.
That's quite interesting, isn't
it? It's fascinating, isn't it, for the Irish? And then the Guardian has a peculiar little a requirement of its editor that it must always do what the editors of the Guardian have done. And that's pretty much the only restriction on the editor of the Guardian. Under the trust document that runs that organisation.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realise The Guardian was run by a trust.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we're just going to have a little track, and then we'll get back to discussing some more national and local news. So, Greg, what's going on in the local news? Tell us.
Locally, hundreds of dead birds I read in Gulf News, found at Whakanefa, the theory being that they just ran out of puff, happened to die over, blown sideways out of a storm. Dozens of dead seabirds. More than 50 dead and dying seabirds were found dotted around Whakanefa Regional Park last Friday morning by resident Philip Tarr, who was checking traps on behalf of a trust.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Andy about that because he's coming in to talk about.
Now I led off with that. I led off with that because it you know, we get so worked up with local politics, don't we? And I just want to remind people of the sort of environmental news that happens on around the island as well. Politically, an issue arising out of the relationship between Fullers and the council. Very delicate, obviously, politically sensitive, because we've got a split on the board, on the local board, over this issue. Denise Roche speaking publicly and purposefully against the idea that any money should be given to Fullers for their volunteer ambassadors for the World Cup.
Mm. So from what I understand, Fullers have applied and got $2,000 from the local board in a split decision. To have unpaid ambassadors promote the Hauraki Gulf.
Yep.
I did think that was
During the Rugby World Cup. During the Rugby World Cup.
And I did think that was really peculiar. I mean, I think one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, why does Fullers, when they're making so much money off their tickets, why can't they
How much money are they making off their tickets?
Well, at the last account, my last 40-ticket pass cost me $465. So four of those would actually fund the uniforms that they want for these ambassadors. And secondly, they're not paying these people anything at all.
No.
So I think it's really cheeky that they've come to the community board and asked them for money. For something which is going to presumably fill their coffers when people buy tickets to come out to the Gulf at $30 a pop.
I guess from my point of view is a little bit more about the board than fillers. Anybody's entitled to, any organisation of any sort's entitled to come to the board and ask for natural support. And even if it might seem inappropriate to some that it's fillers, that's not really the problem for me here. The problem here is the board support. I think the board's naively gone approved this because they see it as generating income visitor. for the visitor industry, and that the World Cup is about to bring tens of thousands of people to Auckland, and if we can do some stuff to funnel some of them over here, it's going to be good for our local businesses, and of course we all want our local businesses to do well. But I think the board's, I personally think the board's made a mistake here. I don't think that that's the right thing to do with public money. There's a special relationship between the ferry operator and the council. Although we might think of this as a monopoly by chance, in that there just isn't a competitor for fullers, the council is in fact obliged to make sure there is a transport provider. And it does what it can to support fullers in appropriate places. For example, and a lot of islanders might not think this is appropriate, but the council does think that it's appropriate that fullers does not pay rent on the wharf. Anybody else using the wharf pays the council rent, but not fullers. And when I've asked why about this in the past, the response has always been because we need a ferry operator, and to make sure that we have one, we provide the offices for them on the wharf. That's one thing. That's legitimate, arguably legitimate, but I don't think that argument can be applied to this, the funding of uniforms and training for ambassadors that the company will do pretty well out of, because while other businesses on the island might also benefit, their bus tours and their ferry tickets are obviously what they're interested in selling, and the council's using ratepayers' money to help them do that. Mm. And I just don't think that the council's got it right here.
Yes, no, I totally agree. And I think for me, the other unfortunate thing when we're talking about fullers at the moment is I'm commuting into town and I'm thinking it's the school holidays. And I wonder why there are very, very few families with children are going over into town in the school holidays, when Auckland offers an abundance of possibilities, both in terms of parks, museums, free events that children can take part in. And it's lovely that there are so many holiday programs running on the island. But I do feel that if it was more affordable for people to travel into town, they would be able to take their children and offer them other things that the city also offers them. And anyway, that's a slightly different issue. But yes, I am quite appalled that Fullers has had the temerity to ask for this money, and also that it's been granted. And good for Denise for sort of making some of those arguments that you've made.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting one. I mean, I've always thought the free rent is slightly dodgy, and that's not a personal grudge against Fullers. Like all islanders, I have some sort of personal grudge against Fullers for other reasons. But it just seems inappropriate that public, if it is going to be a totally unsubsidised ferry run in terms of the cost to passengers, and we enjoy no subsidy, while our half Moon Bay compatriots enjoy a significant subsidy.
Surely they should be paying for the wharf.
Then why are we subsidising? Yeah. Why do we have to pay for their office space as well? But the argument that we need a ferry operator, and if you don't make it convenient for them, you may not have one.
Yes, although, I mean, I think that whole thing of making it convenient for the ferry operator, I mean, they are making a lot of money on this.
How much money
run
are they making? I keep asking this because we don't know. Everybody assumes Fullers is making a lot of money, but Fullers doesn't have to open its books, and it never has. So.
But I think if they weren't making enough money, they would be the first in line to ask for a subsidy. So clearly, they must be making sufficient money to cover any need to come to the community for a subsidy. Mm.
That's a generally held view. I agree, but unfortunately, we can't
Yes, I know.
We
exactly.
can't know. We can't know. And until things
Bring
change
on
around
that. Integrated ticketing. And make Waiheke part of that.
Absolutely.
Anyway. Okay, great. Other things that are quite interesting. I'm finding that, as a national story, I'm finding that that whole thing with the Israeli backpacker with five foreign passports, or was it two?
Yeah.
And quite interesting.
Yeah.
I think that's quite... You know, it's interesting that within 12 hours of the earthquake, suddenly all these, you know, Israelis are able to leave Christchurch when no one else is. And then apparently they get a SWAT team in to get out their Israeli backpacker in some sort of recovery mission.
Yeah.
None of them are qualified to actually do any recovery, so they're not let in.
Yeah.
And, you know, half a day later, they're escorted out by the... SAS.
Yeah,
I thought that was quite an interesting little story.
I know, and a very interesting editorial written by an Israeli editor of a major newspaper in Israel, lambasting the New Zealand media for jumping to stereotypical conclusions and accusing every Israeli abroad of having nefarious purposes. I don't know the truth here, but I hear what you're saying.
And, well, it's quite weird that they've got, you know, five passports, or was it two, or, you know, how many passports was it? Some of them New Zealand in their possession.
Yeah, and of course New Zealand, I think, has every right to be twitchy about this because, you know, it wasn't so long ago there were Mossad agents stealing New Zealand passports for their own intelligence purposes. And I think we should be particularly prickly on that issue, actually. And if some Israelis have been unfortunately tarred, that's an awful thing. But we should be able to discuss this without the Israeli media trying to shut down our debate on it.
Mm-hmm. And talking about, and apparently the other thing that happened is that some of them were given access to the police databases. Did you hear that?
No.
Oh, well, apparently, according to Tumiki, some of them were given access, because they were working in the morgue or something, they were given access to a police database, and now the police are concerned that they might have infiltrated the database and extracted information on New Zealand operatives or people who might not see Israel in a particularly good light. So and my question there is, what are foreign nationals doing
digging around our databases,
playing on the New Zealand police database? I mean, you know, if you're you can't run for election in this country unless you're a citizen. How is it that a foreign national who's, you know, working in New Zealand in some sort of recovery operation is given access to New Zealand police databases?
Well, I hope we get the answer to that.
Mm.
I really do.
Yeah, interesting.
Mm.
And other things that you've come across?
To be honest, I've been hugely busy. There's the gold order story on Waiheke, which is, you know, a good brightener to end on, I suppose.
Yes.
Kim and Jeanette Goldwater, fantastic pioneers of the Waiheke wine industry.
Have you had much to do with them over the years?
Over the years, I've not a lot, to be honest. I think what I have really enjoyed is their Cabernet Merlot. Over the years, to be honest, which very occasionally I used to work in a
restaurant for their conversation just
right.
Pass over the cab.
I used to work in a restaurant where we sold quite a lot of it, and so we got to drink a bit of it as well. And it absolutely remarkable wine, grown in a place where at the time people were saying, you can't grow wine or make wine off grapes grown in Waiheke. It's just too salty. Don't be stupid. And, of course, the Goldwaters just knew what they were doing. And they and other vineyards, not only the Waiheke wine production, of course, actually goes back decades and decades and decades before that. There was a Daly family on the island who made wine back in the 40s or 30s or something.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I always thought the Goldwaters were the first.
They made a rather sickly local sweet wine in the area where the new primary school is now, in that CV Road Valley.
Right.
And I can't remember the name of the guy, I'm afraid. But then the Goldwaters really made wine, along with others, but the Goldwaters were key players. And it's just marvellous to see that whole cycle now of back where this now becomes a community asset.
It's incredibly generous of them. I mean, it's really...
Well,
it's quite a touching story.
It is. It's a wonderful story. It's a truly wonderful story, and they are among the island's, great residents. They really are. And Now that it will become a live-in place for students, I think this is like this is a mini Auckland University of Auckland campus. I mean, we've got other vineyards on the island that are being used for the study of viticulture. Delamore's down there have got that kind of arrangement going as well. But this is a live-in campus, and the idea that there's, you know, I can't remember, a few dozen students are going to be living there on the causeway and studying wine. And
some of them might even be Waiheke students.
Well, yeah, I hope so, yeah. Actually, we were just talking with my wife, Fleur, this morning, and we were talking about how nice it would be if there could be a sort of staircasing course for local kids who have, after all, grown up with the wine industry all around them and just get an opportunity to see if it's for them as a sort of a pre-degree program of some sort, but it's just a nice idea.
Okay, and lastly, I just had a question about national news. I don't know if you've been following John Key's trip to see President Obama.
I saw a picture in the paper today or online of
was it quite disturbing
of John Key and the president. Incongruous came to mind.
Right. Mm. Okay. Yeah. Mm.
Tall and short. Tall and short. Black and white.
Yeah.
You know, noble and no, don't go there.
Well, I thought what's quite interesting is it seems that he's really pushing this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement when there's quite a lot of hostility within New Zealand to it.
Mm.
So I just thought that was quite an interesting kind of thing. And he's also apparently been talking to Homeland Security about getting a Coast Guard boat over. Mm. And we're going to be treated to some US Marines that haven't been here since New Zealand's anti-nuclear stuff.
Did I see something in the paper that they might even be marching up Queen Street?
Oh, really? Oh, no, I thought...
Part of the Rugby World Cup, maybe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is the Marine team.
Oh, okay. Right, I hadn't heard that, so I wonder if that's just an apocryphal story, but, you know, it could be interesting.
No, it's in the newspaper. It's
right,
got to be
okay,
true.
It's got to be true. Okay, well, listen, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, and it looks like it might be sunny, so that prediction of showers is not coming true just yet.
Well,
so
I woke to the most thunderous shower at 5:30, 6 o'clock this morning. It was most thunderous, and to come out today and see it blue and sunny is just such a relief, and I hope everybody enjoys it, and thank
yes.
you very much.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.